Sometimes metaphors get out of control, like riding a bike down a steep mountain when your front brakes seize and you flip over the handlebars and then the bike lands on your head. Sometimes metaphors get out of control like that and it hurts. You get a story out of it for sure, but you still wince a little bit every time you think about it. And there's a metaphor that is used in a couple different ways in Galatians chapter 4, which doesn't necessarily get out of control. Depends on who you ask, I suppose, by the time it's used at the end, allegorically. We'll have to see what that means. There's a surprising amount of references to mothering in this chapter. Would have worked last Sunday as a Sunday evening message on Mother's Day, but nobody would have come back because everybody honors their mothers by not going to church in the evening on Mother's Day. They all come in the morning. The first mention of mothering is not actually a metaphor. It's actually doctrine about Jesus being born of a woman, which is a significant thing as it establishes his humanity. He needed to take on human form so that he could actually take on the curse of the law to redeem a people for himself. And it's absolutely fantastic news that Jesus was born of a woman and born under the law, redeeming us from that curse. And yet, as good of news as that is, the Galatians were going back from it. They were turning away from it, back to some previous ways. And the next time Paul talks about mothering, he talks about himself being in anguish about how they were growing up and how they were actually going back to something that he was not excited about. He was not excited about how they were coming out. It wasn't good. Then he talks about mothering again with two flesh and blood mothers, two actual historical mothers, who he uses to then represent two different spiritual families. And there isn't quite enough appreciation among the Galatians for the fact that they were brothers of this other mother. They actually had one mother, but they were acting like they were brothers of another mother when in fact they were brothers of the same mother. And if they had gotten that mother right, then he probably wouldn't have felt like a mother in anguish. So again, this is a lot of mothering talk. The Galatians were actually turning their back on their mom, on their spiritual mom, and we'll see what that looks like. So this is a very tall mountain, but one that we need to ride our bike down, ideally without having the bike land on our head. The entire letter of Galatians is really an affectionate, motherly spanking to the church in Galatia. They have been hanging out with some bad company, some false teachers who we'll see again in this chapter, tried to make themselves look better than the Galatians, and in so doing tried to make the Galatians wish that they could be with them, with these false teachers, which is really a brilliant way to make others appreciate you by playing on their sensitive consciences. Since as the leader, you don't have a sensitive conscience. You just play on theirs, and then you can make them do what you want. And that's what these false teachers were doing. So chapter 4 continues, like the whole letter, to argue for faith and promise against works and law. And I don't think any of the guys have mentioned it in a while, but part of the reason why we're doing these studies of epistles on Sunday nights is because especially some of our younger people, and they're well represented tonight, so that's exciting, but some of our younger people have not heard as much teaching from the New Testament as some of us who are older. So some of us, and I know lots of our backgrounds, we're heavy in New Testament teaching, and that's good, but there's a way to get stuck in that we need some Old Testament, whether that's the historical or the writing, Psalms and Proverbs or Ecclesiastes, or even some of the prophetic writings as well. We need a lot of that background to get out of our dualism, and getting stuck in the epistles is no good. That said, a lot of our young people haven't gotten the epistles, and I think that, as far as I'm concerned, the book of Galatians is especially helpful for young people growing up in a world where increasing number of Protestants are going back to Catholicism and to Eastern Orthodoxy, which is a going back to certain kinds of rituals and laws because they're old. And so much in evangelical Protestantism today is seeming to be new. And I'm not sure that it's as big of a problem that it's new as much as it is light and trivial and flippant. And people growing up in that feel like they need something deeper. They need something more rooted. And so they turn back to these really old institutions, which include not a lot of free grace, but a lot of rules and regulations and rituals. It is too much happening today that young people especially are susceptible to that kind of pull and influence. And even in this chapter, Galatians chapter 4, ideally you'll see that that is bad. The Galatians were being pulled back to something that they were being told was better and older and God-given. And Paul says it actually is damning and crushing, not freeing. Older, yes, but not better. So if you are one of the youngest kids and you've got a kid's corner, I think you're looking or listening for three main points tonight, and they all relate to being sons. And first we'll see in verses 1 through 7 that we are sons, not slaves. Sons, not slaves. At the end of chapter 3, Paul referred to the law as a guardian until Christ came. So God gave the law, and the law was watching over the Jews and even then pointing the Jews to Jesus. And there's a sense in which, while being that younger son, you did not yet have legal rights to your inheritance until you came of age. And that's still true today. If you watch a series of unfortunate events, the Baudelaires have an enormous fortune that they don't have access to yet because they're not old enough. They are minors. They are not yet of age, and so they don't get access to this wealth. So likewise, Paul is saying that as a people, they were not ready. They were not of age to receive this inheritance. And so in that sense, at the beginning of chapter 4, he says, you're really no different than a slave. So this child, maybe better translated minor, I mean that the heir, as long as he is a child or as long as he is a minor, is no different from a slave. He is different, but he's no different from a slave in the sense of not having access to this inheritance yet. He's the owner of everything. It's his rightful due. But what makes the difference is the date set by his father. The father determines when he is ready to get that inheritance. And for the nation of Israel, for the Jews, that related to coming of age when Christ came. The law was guarding them. The law was pointing them to Jesus. That was when they were ready to receive what God had promised to them. Paul applies this to the Galatians. He says, In the same way, we also were enslaved to the principles of the world. And a few years ago, I probably would have had a completely different take on what this phrase, principles of the world, is referring to. And I read a variety of commentaries again this week and study Bibles and things like that. And some people think that these principles of the world relate to very basic ABC kind of things, like the alphabet that you learn when you're a kid. That obviously fits with the being a child who is not of age yet. I'm not sure that that's the best understanding. They were enslaved to the ABCs. I don't think that that fits what he's talking about the most. It's kind of surprising that he talks about them being enslaved to something other than sin, which he talked about in chapter 3, verse 22, or enslaved to the law, chapter 3, verses 23 through 25. The fact that he even changes the idea of what they were slaves to at all is significant. If you look down at verse 8, he makes another comment about being enslaved to those that by nature are not gods. And so he's connecting this being enslaved idea to the principles of the world, to those that are not gods. Then in verse 9, he uses even another phrase, the worthless elementary principles of the world, which even seems to be connected to verse 10 and their celebration of days and months and seasons and years. So while Paul had been talking about a sort of enslavement to the Mosaic law, here I think he is specifically pulling in how the Gentiles were also enslaved to something, and it wasn't the Mosaic law, but it was the gods of men. It was some pagan understanding, some material and even astronomical gods, as in the planets. And that's why I said a couple minutes ago, as of a few years ago, I would have probably laughed at anybody who told me that. But in reading about the pre-Copernican cosmology and how people, pre-Copernicus, and Copernicus is the one who argued and fought to see that the sun was at the center of the universe as opposed to what before that many people thought of as the earth at the center of the universe. And then there were only seven planets at that point, including the earth, and they went out. So the earth and the moon all the way out. I think that the last one was Saturn. So they didn't have the technology to see some of the other planets that we know about today. And they also thought that the earth was at the center. And part of what went along with that in pagan belief was that these planets had influence on the affairs of men. And that's why you would study astronomy. We would talk about planetary influence today more under the terms of astrology and when you read the horoscope and what month it is, what season it is, what day it is. All of those are said to be influenced by, at least, if not controlled by, the planets and the movements of the stars. And that actually, while today we think of it as super silly, it seems like generations of people took that really seriously. And so I actually think that when Paul is describing all of these phrases, even down to enslaved to those which are not gods, that in many cases there were beings, and the only kind of beings they could really be are demons. There were demons who were connected with some of these beliefs and associations and maybe even with planets, so that some of the Greek mythology and Roman pantheon and Norse mythology, all of which were basically trying to argue for some of the same things. And even though I have not watched any of the Thor stuff or the I'm already out of my league when I make that reference. But some of those characters are modern adaptations of old gods that were not really gods. And that's what I think Paul is referring to, not super specifically, because then he says they're not really gods. But there was a belief system based off of material things and even planetary things that had rule over the affairs of men, and some of the Galatians had been enslaved to those sorts of beliefs. In the same way that the law wasn't enough, so also this false system of how the world runs wasn't enough. What they needed was a savior. None of those gods and no planet has ever died for sake of sinners. They needed Jesus. So when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. This is Jesus. Jesus was God. Jesus was God's Son, so of the same nature as God. Jesus was not just God being God's Son. Jesus was of man because he was born of a woman. So God and man. Jesus was part of a particular family who had obligations to the Jewish system of worship under the law. And it specifically says Jesus came to redeem us so that we might receive adoption as sons, so to bring us into his family. And that is brand new in first century. There wasn't any other story like that. There wasn't any other God that engaged with humanity on behalf of humanity for sake of taking sacrifice instead of them, like being taking the punishment for them, a sacrifice on their behalf. There weren't any other so-called gods who had that kind of love and sacrifice. And Jesus then comes and redeems those to be sons. And this is a tight-knit group that he is creating. God sent not only his Son to be the sacrifice like that, but then also sent his Spirit, the Spirit of his Son, into our hearts so that we have God dwelling in us and even can relate to God the Father intimately, crying, Abba, Father. And every commentator I have ever seen says that the Abba is that term of endearment. Like for us, we would say daddy. And I cannot bring myself to call God my daddy. I can't do it. It seems too frivolous of a comment. And yet, that is part of what we're supposed to get out of it, is that we get to call him Father. And it is that close because of the work of his Son and the work of his Spirit connecting us to the Father. Very similar to what Paul told the Romans in Romans 8:15, that we have received the Spirit of adoption as sons, by whom we cry, Abba, Father. And all of that makes us heirs through God, meaning that it is his work to bring us into that relationship. It's not our work, it's his work. So we are sons and heirs through God. We are sons, not slaves. We're not slaves of sin. We're not slaves of the law. We're not slaves of these elementary principles. We are now sons and part of God's family, which leads to the center part of the chapter in verses 8 through 20, and this is the second description of sons, sons of anguish, at least related to Paul's desire to see them grow up as sons, sons of anguish. While we are sons, one characteristic of sons, I am one. I know the thing about being a son. And one characteristic of sons is that they can be foolish. Enter the Galatians from stage right into the acting out of being foolish sons. They were not only doing dumb stuff, they were doing the same dumb stuff that they had done before that then they got saved out of, and now they're going back to it. They were turning back to the weak and worthless elementary principles of the world. They were turning back to these principles. They were turning back to some of these enslaving gods that they had before. They considered them to be gods. They were enslaved to these gods, even though Paul says by nature they're not gods. So you can take one example, like, all right, Jupiter. Jupiter the planet, Jupiter the god, Jupiter the force or principle, maybe with some kind of demon being behind the object of their service. Just take one. There's lots. They're turning back to these elementary principles. And he says, but now you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God. This is what you should be living in, rather than this previous way of behaving and worshiping. Regularly in the Old and the New Testament, you could identify believers as those who know God and non-believers or New Testament non-Christians as those who don't know God. For example, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 5 talks about those who are enslaved to their passions. And the reason why they're enslaved to their passions is because they don't know God. And this knowing God and being known by God is a beautiful Calvinistic, God-centered description where being known, knowing another, and being known is that Bible language for intimate relationship. Obviously, God in His omniscience knows all things and all persons, but to be known here means that God is like that Father with the Son, a familial, close, connected relationship. And we know Him because He first knew us. It doesn't mean, because sometimes Calvinists get a little bit fussy, and we don't like hearing anybody make any kind of comment like, I love God. Well, no. God's Spirit is sovereignly at work in you, making it so that the fruit of love comes out of you, but it's not really you. It's God in you. Like, all right, sure. Yes, because we don't breathe apart from God. I'm breathing. Well, technically, because of God's sovereignty, it's not really you who is breathing. It is God who is enabling all of those things to make it so that breathing is what your body is doing, but it's God's grace that you breathe. And so that's true. And in particular context, maybe we do need to have that conversation. Someone is saying, I'm doing this autonomously or independently from God. Well, that's a problem. But Paul is not correcting, he is adding on to the comment, those who know God, or rather, or in addition to, have been known by God. So God is the initiator, and He is the one who gets all of the credit, but that doesn't mean that we can't say, oh, I don't actually know God, it's that God knows me. Well, in His knowing of me, that works then back out through me actually really getting to know Him. It is that relationship. And rather than enjoy that fellowship, because that seems amazing, rather than enjoy that fellowship, they had gone back to days and months and seasons and years. Rather than trusting their Father and seeking His will, they were more attuned to the calendar, the stars, the planets, the astronomical or astrological signs. That's why you would pay attention to days and months and seasons and years. Those are established, and even God said in the beginning that He gave lights and planets for the sake of being able to measure those, watch those cycles, and they had turned back away from fellowship with their Father to pay attention to the calendar. Now, if this interpretation is true, then Paul, according to one commentator, Paul, quote, virtually equates Judaism with heathenism. To go forward into Judaism is to go backward into heathenism, end quote, which means that there is dependence on something other than supernatural grace, something other than God being in control and giving mercy and salvation, and us trying to have some kind of human work, human wisdom that we live our lives upon. So Paul then turns to a personal appeal, reminding them again of the connection that they made, even the connection not just between themselves and God the Father, but between themselves and Himself. And he reminds them that they had cared for him as he'd cared for them, even with some physical problem that he had. The ESV translates it as a bodily ailment. Nobody seems to know for sure what that bodily ailment is. Maybe it was connected with his eyesight, because he says in just a verse or two, you would have plucked out your own eyes for me. Maybe that was just an extreme example, a description of what they would have gone through, or maybe it related to the problem that he was having, that being his bodily ailment. Whatever his bodily ailment was, it tempted them, would have tempted them to scorn and despise him. That word despise, the ESV translates it that way. In the Greek dictionary that I looked at, has as spitting or spitting out. Something was so awful about his condition that it would have made them want to spit him out. That's a more physical expression than of contempt. And instead of doing that, they had received him as an angel of God and even as Christ Jesus. And you remember the one story in Acts where he was received as one of the gods, and he says, "No, I'm just a servant, I'm just a messenger." Here he doesn't seem to correct them as them appreciating him like an angel, even as Jesus Christ. And the reason why here it seems like, because what does an angel do? An angel is a messenger from God, bringing revelation from God. So it seems like that they had received him positively. Even though he had come in weakness, they acknowledged that he brought a divine message. And they cared for him. If possible, as I mentioned earlier, they would have gouged out their eyes and given them to Paul. Paul and the Galatians were tight. They had a hashtag blessedness that they knew together. And their attitude towards him now was the opposite. Before he had told them the truth and they had overlooked his problems, now the fact that he was telling them the truth was a problem, as they had turned away from them. He asked them, "Have I then become your enemy by telling you the truth?" Which leads to verse 17, the sad, ironic twist. The false teachers, Paul says, make much of you, but for no good purpose. They want to shut you out that you may make much of them. And I don't love all of the articles. They go around in cycles about leaders who abuse their followers. I saw one just this afternoon on some link to some article about leaders in the church who abuse their followers, not sexually, it's not what this one was about, but in leadership kind of ways. And obviously that is something that happens. And I do actually think that Paul is describing a kind of situation like that here. I'm not sure that abuse is the best word to describe it in light of some of the actual kinds of abuses that can happen. But nevertheless, somehow, these leaders got close enough to convince the people, you know, that the leaders convinced the people that the people, they were really great, until it was time to tell those same people, but you're not great enough just yet. In order to be really great, you've got to exalt us. You've got to follow our additional rules and our rituals. So somehow making those followers feel like less and therefore pleasing the leaders less, and Paul is pointing out that the Galatians, in receiving that teaching and letting the false teachers treat them that way, is not better. And that kind of behavior goes along with a rejection of the gospel of grace. As soon as you give up salvation by grace alone through faith alone, then you open it up for the people who are preaching some other message to abuse that, to then decide what else needs to be added on to grace and faith. And that's what was happening in Galatia. So Paul likens his response to seeing them following this foolish path. He likens his response to what's happening like that of a mother. "My little children, for whom I am again in the anguish of childbirth until Christ is formed in you." When he was first with them, preaching to them, he suffered labor pains to see their faith birthed. And now that some of them were going back to their ways before salvation, Paul is having similar kinds of birth pains again until they would grow up all the way into maturity in Jesus. It is as if they are climbing back into the womb of ignorance and darkness. And Paul wants them to get out and grow up. So he uses this mothering tone because he is perplexed about them, like a mom with her son might be. So they are sons, not slaves, but they are sons of anguish because of the foolish direction that they were headed. Now in verses 21 to 31, the final set of sons, the final part of the chapter, Paul returns to remind them that they are sons of promise. Now this final part, this third and final part of the chapter, gets a lot of people fired up in terms of how Paul uses the Old Testament. It is mostly people who take interpreting the Bible seriously who get upset. And I want to acknowledge that that is good and bad, that you can typically tell the people who are serious about the Bible by the furrowed brow on their face. And, right, it's not the heretics who are heresy hunters. It's not the people who are loose with doctrine who get into a conniption about people who are loose with their doctrine. It's the serious Bible people who get serious about potential problems with teaching and the Bible. And the Bible itself says we, at least to Timothy, so at least to teachers, but I think by way of application, those who are reading and studying the Bible for themselves, we ought to study to show ourselves approved, rightly dividing our copies of God's Word. That is one thing, but maybe there is a way to do that with gladness rather than hermeneutical bow and arrows ready to shoot everybody who potentially has, said something in a way we wouldn't say it. And, this is the air I breathe, so I'm all about being grumpy at bad interpretation. I know how to red pen all kinds of books and go to meetings and begin with all of the things I know are problems hermeneutically in terms of their interpretation. They totally proof text that. They got it out of context. They're too loose. I understand that. Paul himself here takes seriously that those who think salvation comes by faith and works of whatever other kind, Paul takes that very seriously, because if you think that salvation comes by something other than by faith and grace alone, then you're believing a different gospel, which is not actually a gospel, which means there's not actually salvation. And yet, at the same time, he does want us to cut straight along the razor's edge, and pointing out in this paragraph a way to see that it's by faith and not by works without making our literal interpretation fingers bloody. So yes, it's a razor's edge, and yes, we need to understand it, and yes, we need to fight about the right things, but I'm not convinced that we need to panic about how Paul is proving his point in this final paragraph. So I haven't done it with the verses up to this point, but I do want to read verses 21 through 31 altogether and then make a couple comments. So verse 21, tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not listen to the law? That's a fantastic question. For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by a slave woman and one by a free woman. But the son of the slave was born according to the flesh, while the son of the free woman was born through promise. Now this may be interpreted allegorically. Oh no. That's the potential danger right there. Now this may be interpreted allegorically. These women are two covenants. But shouldn't the women be women? Not how can women be covenants. Women should be women, and covenants are covenants, not women be covenants. But let's hear what he has to say. Now this may be interpreted allegorically. These women are two covenants. One is from Mount Sinai, bearing children for slavery. She is Hagar. Now Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. So now we don't just have a woman who is a covenant. Now we've got a woman who is a mountain. And I can already tell you that that's not how to woo your lady friend. So don't date allegorically following Paul's model and write poetry as such. She is Mount Sinai in Arabia, she corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. So now we've got a woman who's actually a covenant, who's actually a mountain, who is actually a city, who is all enslaved. Like, if you're going to do allegory, you might as well do it upright. But the Jerusalem above is free, and she is our mother, which presumably is meant to get us back to the second woman, the other woman. So you've got two women who are mothers, and this heavenly Jerusalem is a mother, must be connected with Sarah, even though her name is not mentioned. Then Paul quotes another Old Testament passage, "Rejoice, O barren one who does not bear. Break forth and cry aloud, you who are not in labor. For the children of the desolate one will be more than those of the one who has a husband. Now you, brothers, like Isaac, are children of promise. But just as at that time, he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit, so also it is now. But what does the Scripture say? Quote, cast out the slave woman and her son, for the son of the slave woman shall not inherit with the son of the free woman," end quote. So, brothers, we are not children of the slave, but of the free woman. That seems like a lot. And that word allegorical in between also seems problematic. So how should we understand it? I mean, first, the question in verse 21 is pretty clear. We haven't messed anything up with literal interpretation here. Paul is pointing out it's almost as if those who were adamant about the law weren't actually that familiar with the law. Of course, that never happens, that people get fussy about the law who don't actually know anything about the law. And the people who are the most argumentative about the Constitution never read the Constitution. Of course, that's a regular thing that happens. They exalted being sons of Abraham. That's what they were concerned about. That is a large concern why the Judaizers were making other people get circumcised so that they could be part of that Abrahamic line. And Paul actually points out that Father Abraham had many sons. And while I was channeling that song, Father Abraham had many sons, it does actually matter which was your mom in getting to be one of his sons as to how you're connected to it all. So the story that Paul starts referring to in verse 22 is a story found in Genesis 16 through 21. And he doesn't actually quote from that group of chapters until near the end of this paragraph. The first and most important two sons of Abraham are Ishmael and Isaac. They're not named at this point in verse 22. Both of whom had Abraham as a father, but each had a different mother. And not only did each have a different mother, but each one from a different mother was born in a different manner. So one was born by a slave woman, and the other was by a free woman, though Sarah, you know, when we read verses 21 through 31, Sarah's name is not used at all. So not only is Sarah's name not used at all in Galatians, but also Sarah is never designated as the free woman in the Old Testament. Paul is contrasting Hagar, who was definitely the slave, who then became a wife, with Sarah, who presumably by contrast, was free. But she's never actually called a free woman in Genesis or anywhere else in the Old Testament. So we've got two women. One's a slave woman, one is a free woman, as Paul describes them. And then there are two different ways of birth. One is born according to the flesh, and the other was born through promise. And you remember in Genesis 16 through 21 that Sarai, at that point, was not giving Abraham any kids. So since she couldn't give him any kids, she gave her husband her handmaid, her slave, Hagar, and thought that then Sarai would be able to count Hagar's kid as her own. So this was a son conceived through human scheming, human planning, and human energy. And obviously somebody could say, well, any birth is miraculous. So even Ishmael's birth was due to God's work, and that is true, but it was God working through the typical and normal means of people who could still get pregnant. Sarah was not getting pregnant at that point, and so Ishmael was born according to the flesh. The other son, the second son, came when both Abram and Sarai were past the age when it was even possible to bear kids in these human terms. So Isaac was actually conceived via supernatural intervention. It wasn't God using natural means to bring about God's ends. It was God needing to intervene in a unique way. And then Paul says, now this may be interpreted allegorically. And what I understand that to mean is that Paul is adding an additional point on top of the historical fact, the historical narrative. And one commentator says it like this, using one set of realities, the narrative of Sarah and Hagar, to speak of another set of realities. And even the Greek word allegoreo is able to be broken down into those two parts. So agoreo, which means to speak or I speak, and alla in this case meaning other things. So to speak of other things. But what is different is that Paul starts with the history, with the historical fact, and he doesn't deny the historical fact or claim that the allegory is the point. Nor does Paul even say that when Moses wrote it, Moses was trying to include this hidden deeper meaning. And that is what those who believe in allegorical interpretation of the Bible, and that has been a popular thing, not as much today, and we can give thanks to God for that, that we don't have to try to sift through a lot of allegorical teaching. Allegorical teaching today still happens, but they don't call it that because the people who buy it wouldn't understand the word allegory. But it was a more popular method of trying to interpret the Bible and seeing different levels of meaning that allegorical interpretators believed God had put in there on purpose through the original writers. Even John Calvin said this, quote, Paul certainly does not mean that Moses wrote the history for the purpose of being turned into an allegory, but points out in what way the history may be made to answer the present subject. And that is not how we think of allegory, so we probably would use a different word than allegory, even though I think that that's a fair translation of the Greek word in this passage. Because when we think of allegory, even in the dictionary, the English dictionary I looked up, allegory, says that allegory is a fictional story or poem or picture that can be interpreted to reveal a hidden meaning. But our understanding of allegory is that the point of the story is the hidden meaning that you have to try to find. And it teaches some moral or some political point. Whereas Paul is not denying that the point in Genesis is the history of it. He just sees that there is a way to see that history and attach it to this particular situation he's also trying to explain to the Galatians. Paul sees a comparison that can be used against the law lovers, those who are going back to elementary principles or to things that they ought not be. So he sees in the actual historical narrative a comparison in two parts. The first part is a slave woman named Hagar, who's also Mount Sinai, present Jerusalem, and the key about present Jerusalem is that it is rejecting Christ and children who are enslaved to the law. All of that, all together, represents human effort and energy that is enslaved. That's what you get out of Hagar, is enslavement. And it is connected with the Mosaic Covenant, which is the law, which brings about slavery, which Paul has already said multiple times in Galatians. That's the first part that's being compared. The second part of the comparison is the free woman, Sarah, though her name isn't mentioned. In terms of a comparative mountain, maybe there isn't a mountain opposite of Mount Sinai. I kind of wonder if we could include Mount Moriah, which is where Abraham took Isaac. So if I was going to try to put in a mountain, I might put in Mount Moriah. So the free woman Sarah, the mountains of Moriah, or the mountains in the region of Moriah, Jerusalem above, and the Jerusalem above is receiving Christ instead of rejecting Christ, that results in children who are free because of promise. And all of what the second part of the comparison tries to emphasize or represent is divine grace and divine initiative that ends slavery. One ends with being enslaved, and the other ends in getting out of slavery. And I don't actually think that this covenant, Paul says there's two covenants that the ladies represent. Clearly one is the Mosaic covenant given on Mount Sinai. I don't think that this is the new covenant, but rather the Abrahamic covenant and Christ as that promised seed of Abraham who would be the fulfillment of bringing blessing to all the nations. So you've got the two women representing the two covenants. You've got the Mosaic covenant, the law. You've got the Abrahamic covenant, which was all about God's initiating promise that he brought about then through Isaac and then ultimately now even through Jesus. And this Jerusalem above that is free, she's our mother. I'm not convinced that this is a description of the church, but rather a description of grace instead of law. The new Jerusalem that is rejecting Jesus, or I'm sorry, the present Jerusalem that's rejecting Jesus compared to the Jerusalem above that is free is talking about God's grace to his people, grace that births many children. And when he quotes Isaiah 54:1 in Galatians chapter 4, verse 27, he's talking about the children of grace are going to be even more. The desolate one is going to have even more children, all by grace. The believers then are the brothers. They are like Isaac. They are children of promise. That's great news. But just as at that time he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the spirit, so also it is now. And you might remember back in Genesis that when Ishmael was a teenager, he at least laughed at the old people who were excited that Isaac was born. Could be translated as laughed at, could be translated as mocked. It fired Sarah up so much so that she told Abraham that he needed to kick out Hagar and Ishmael. And so Abram actually sent them away. That comment comes in Genesis 21:10. Paul applies it to the Galatians. They should understand that the other son, who represents those who are conceived by human effort, human energy and human effort, those ones are going to give grief to any son of divine grace and promise. Men who are religious in natural ways rather than supernatural ways give grief to those who are saved by faith alone. Brought about an entire upheaval a few centuries ago as the one group were natural sons giving grief to the ones who were sons of grace. John Calvin, and I mean, sometimes he gets saucy. This is particularly so. This is from his commentary on this verse. John Calvin said, "The papists are fools and twice children who expect to give us uneasiness by producing these words, for their mother is an adulteress who brings forth to death the children of the devil." But sure, keep hanging out in the Catholic Church if you want to. No, that the quote ended before that last part, the snark that I added. Final reminder is we are not children of the slave, but of the free woman. We are children of promise. We are children of grace. We who receive Jesus do not have to go back to being enslaved by the law, by anything. Children of promise, born of the Spirit, not of human scheming or effort or accomplishment. It is very personal. We are born of the Spirit. And the next time I talk from Galatians, we'll see in Galatians chapter 5 that those who are born of the Spirit should walk according to the Spirit. Because we are born of the free woman, that is, because we are born by grace, we should live in freedom. That also comes about in chapter 5, talking about not submitting again to a yoke of slavery. So Paul is saying, don't go back to the law. Don't go back to the elementary principles. Don't go back to anything that enslaves. We are free in Jesus. And of course, that can be abused, just like the doctrine of justification by faith alone can be abused. And people then use that as a cover to sin and live however they want. And that is not how it's supposed to be. Galatians 5 will actually tell us that there is a way that we live, but it is a way that we live based and energized by the Spirit, not from the outside, but from the inside out. So yes, it can be abused, but the answer is not then to find something deep. The answer is to find that thing that is supernatural. So again, young people, as you read and listen to people's testimonies, leaving Protestantism, which is a sola fide group, and heading back towards candles and incense and days and months and year kind of required festivals, remember that as sons of promise, sons of the free woman, you don't need that to be connected to God. It is through Jesus and His Spirit and the freedom of the gospel that we are connected to God, and that's part of what makes it really good news. It can be abused, but typically by people who are still in the flesh, and we'll have to see that next time in Galatians 5. Father, thanks for the opportunity to consider these things, and help us not be foolish like the Galatians were. Help us not to be deceived by others who would make us feel bad because we're not doing the right thing. We're not doing the spiritual thing, the old thing, the better thing. Help us to exult in the freedom that we have in your Son, and also then to live in His name in everything that we do. So thank you again for the great and sovereign gospel of grace. And may you find us not only thankful and praising you for it, but living according to it. And I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.